It's 1:36 p.m., and this is the meeting of the House Judiciary Committee, and we're called to order. Before we get started, I would like to remind committee members to, and everyone else in the room, to turn off your cell phones. And we have present today, we have Representative Kopp, Representative Eastman, Representative Reinbold, Representative LeBoux, my Vice Chair, Representative Fansler, and myself, Representative Klayman. Representative Grant is also in the room, as he's one of the bills we have in front of us, and we do have a quorum to do business. Our first order of business today is a motion from my Vice Chair, Representative Fansler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that Representative Klayman, the Chair of the House Judiciary Committee, be delegated the duties and responsibilities in AS 2408060A during regular and special sessions of the 30th Alaska State Legislature. This delegation remains in effect until withdrawn by the committee.
Are there any objections to the motion from Representative Hanslip?
Sure.
Is there an objection to the motion?
Yes.
Okay. Gives the chair the authority to introduce committee.
When I had introduced a committee bill, how come I didn't ask his permission to do that? And I said, well, I've never had anybody ask permission to introduce a committee bill. I mean, just because it's a committee bill doesn't mean that everybody in the committee necessarily supports the bill, but bills have routinely been introduced as committee bills simply by the chair of the committee introducing a committee bill. And Wes said to me that he didn't have any problems with the exact bill, but he thought that he should be consulted. And we talked about this last year. You weren't there, Representative Reinbold, in the House Majority Caucus. And Representative Keller actually gave me an opinion from, I think it was legislative legal, that said that you're either supposed to seek the permission of the committee every time you introduce a committee bill, and you don't need unanimous consent from the committee, you simply need a majority of the members present, or in the alternative, you can get a delegation of authority from the committee to introduce a committee bill. So that's sort of how it came about, this opinion.
Representative Kopp.
Mr. Chairman, is there anything in this delegation that would inhibit a member of the committee's informed discussion of the bill, or saying they like it or don't like it, or voting for or against it and being on the record?
No, it would never prevent a member of the committee from saying they don't support it as a committee bill, and my general approach as chair would be to talk with members of the committee about making it a committee bill. I wouldn't view that as a consensus process. If I had a sense that the majority of the committee supported it, I would and might well introduce it as a committee bill. If it was clear that the committee and majority did not support it, I would not be introducing it as a committee bill, because that would seem to me to be over-exercising my authority as chair. But that's kind of my end. But I would, just as with making this motion, I think I spoke with everyone on the committee in advance to explain it.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I do appreciate that. And I guess my point is we would still vote on moving the bill. If there was an objection, you would still be able to exercise that.
Absolutely. Not only that, but to the extent the bill gets introduced to the committee bill, everyone on the committee would still have the opportunity to move to amend that bill as they see fit, and as amended, it would still be a committee. The committee bill would be the amended bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Eastman.
Question either to you or the maker of the motion. Under what sort of circumstances would you want to exercise this? I'm thinking of, you mentioned majority. Would it be in the case of any time a majority of the committee supported a piece of legislation? And I'm trying to distinguish between simply a majority of one vote versus a consensus of most of those in the committee, or perhaps all. So I think there's probably a distinction to be made between simply members of one caucus supporting a bill as opposed to the committee as a whole.
And I guess there's not any simple answer to that. It depends on the circumstances. I mean, a perfect example, we heard Representative Wilson's bill, and a lot of people had a lot of questions, and the Department of Law had a lot of questions, and they're talking about working with the sponsor, and so that's the kind of bill that, to the extent there's support from different members of the committee that constituted a majority that would support a different version, I would potentially look at introducing that as a committee substitute rather than a sponsor substitute. But again, there's too many different hypotheticals to try to answer, but my intent would not be to use it to try to discuss with members of the committee to get a sense from what people represent by conference.
I was just going to comment additionally. When the deadline for personal legislation comes and goes, at least in my 4 years, committee legislation has traditionally been a means to address problems that are outstanding and that need to sort of be expedited and having outstanding authority. That's, I think, the most common instance in which I've seen committee legislation used. It's relatively infrequent. And the only other comment I was going to add is, I had no idea that this was, in fact, there was a statute. The way things are supposed to be, because for my 4 years, committee legislation, it just always appeared like magic. This process seems more forthright and transparent. So I'm good with it, and as long as it's sort of used judiciously and conservatively.
Who's on the Judiciary Committee?
The right committee for that.
Representative Reinbold, you had a follow-up question or comment?
Yes, I'm going to reiterate what I've heard. Basically, my preference, first of all, is to seek permission, before you introduce legislation from members, especially if it has the judiciary name on it. And it sounds like you're only going to be introducing bills if you get this through the committee. And you are not going to introduce anything that you don't believe you have majority support for. My question to you is why?
Just note that's a majority of the committee. Go ahead.
Correct. And I'm not sure how you're gonna know that without talking to all of us. But basically, why would you not just, as chairman of the Judiciary Committee, put your name so everybody knows, you know, who is the movement behind the bill? And I'll give you an example. Senate Bill 91, you and I are on completely opposite planets of that. I'm not sure if you're going to be introducing something, you know, in regards to that, that I wouldn't want me to in any way look like I'm supportive of something that I'm adamantly opposed to. For example, Senate Bill 91, you carried it on the floor. So with that, I definitely plan on maintaining my objective, but I want to, if there's anything you need to clarify what I've said, I'd appreciate it.
No, I think you are very able to articulate your objections where you are now, and I would anticipate that whether it's bill sponsored by any other member of our body or a committee bill, that if you didn't agree, you would voice your objections, and I have no intention of limiting your ability to do so. Seeing no other comments, if the court could call the roll.
Excuse
me,
Representative
Chancellor?
Aye.
Yay. Representative
Eastman? Yes.
Representative
Grimebold?
No.
Representative
Cox?
Yes.
Representative
Clyde Swanson?
Yes.
Representative Steve is an alternate. Representative Ledoux?
Yes.
Chair Clayman?
Yes.
One
so the motion carries. Our next order of business is House Bill 44, Legislative Ethics, Voting in Conflicts, and House Concurrent Resolution 1, Amend Uniform Rules, Abstain from Voting. This is the second hearing on the bill and concurrent resolution. We have already heard the sponsor's presentation and taken public testimony. At this time, I'll ask the sponsor, Representative Grant, and his aide, Ryan Johnston, to come forward. Put yourself on the record and briefly refresh the committee on House Bill 44 and House Concurrent Resolution 1 and answer follow-up questions that may have arisen since we finished last time. And I would just note as you're coming forward, I believe there's one person that may have called in to provide public testimony. At this point, the public hearing is closed. And I'm not inclined to reopen the public hearing, as I know there's some amendments and we may be looking at some revisions to the bill, and I will consider reopening public hearing at our next meeting, but I'm not inclined to open up the public hearing today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Representative Jason Glenn, proudly representing District 22 in Anchorage.
Ryan Johnston, staff representative Jason Glenn.
Did you have any comments you wanted to add as we get started today?
Yeah. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Ryan Johnston, staff for Representative Gren. Quickly, again, HB 44 provides a concise outline for the standards at which a legislator can review to determine whether or not they have a conflict of interest. And then House Concurrent Resolution 1 is an amendment to House Uniform House Rule 34B, changing from a unanimous consent to a majority consent for an abstention for a legislator. And two questions to answer for the committee. Through the chair, Representative Vanzler, we're still waiting to hear back from other states on their journal records on abstentions and that material. And then for Representative Eastman, through the chair, Representative Eastman, we talked to the House clerk, and there is an ability to withdraw your motion currently. Once you've asked for a motion to abstain, you can actually remove that motion. And then from the interpretation of the clerk in the implementation of House Concurrent Resolution 1 and HB 44 in its current form, that would still be allowed only before a vote. So if the vote was cast, you would not be able to withdraw the motion. So and that concludes my comments.
I don't see any follow-up questions or comments. No, that's your comment for that. Okay. And at this time, we can now consider amendments. Are there any amendments? Representative Reason?
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number 1.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Move amendment number 1. There's amendment number 1 has been moved. I think that's been distributed, and I'll object for purposes of discussion. Go ahead, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This amendment amends House the current resolution, one, to allow members up to 5 minutes on the floor to explain their conflict of interest, and also permits that a member may not be permitted to abstain from a vote, as is current, except, and this is the change, upon an affirmative vote of two-thirds of the full membership of the House. Thank you.
Well, I guess, first off, Representative Gren, what's your perspective on Amendment Number 1?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Easton, when we started putting this bill together, our research, our objection was to, one, put this vote on record. And so we, through our research, we found a vast majority of other states have the language that we put forth regarding a majority vote, but we also wanted to be consistent with our Alaska statute that puts this conflict of interest vote regarding municipalities and a majority vote. And so we looked at wanting to stay consistent, and that was our main goal with the language that we put forth. With that said, we also drafted this proposal with the hope that pragmatic logic would be the approach that those voting would use when voting on the abstention. But understanding there is more to that sometimes within a body, we are at least willing to discuss the amendment from Representative Eastman.
Representative Chris Tompkins.
Thank you. A compelling amendment, and it seems like there are two substantive components to it, the first being raising the threshold for an affirmative vote to two-thirds from a mere majority, and the other being 5 minutes of speaking time. And the former, I think I can sort of infer the logic. The latter, I'm assuming, Representative Eastman, if you might be able to comment or sort of expound on the thinking behind that component of the amendment.
Certainly. Now, is this a through the chair, or can I speak directly to the committee member? How does that work?
I think that because this is, I think you can speak directly to the committee member.
Thank you. Well, thanks for the question.
Okay. You can speak directly to the committee member.
Thank you.
The former representative would have, at this point, asked for permission to dialogue.
And so with the advice from the person the committee room is named after, I will gladly welcome the dialogue and grant permission to do so.
Thank you. In the spirit of dialogue then, currently the word or the verbiage in uniform rules is brief. And I understand that we're now asking perhaps a little bit more of someone when they rise to speak to an objection. And so the 5 minutes was designed to give them sufficient opportunity with the expectation that it's very unlikely that everyone would take that full 5 minutes. Perhaps no one would. Generally, if you're speaking to an objection and conflicts, we want to make sure that since there is going to be a vote and that's going to go on record, that everyone who participates in that vote has sufficient, time in listening to the position of the person raising the objection, that that they understand and can be, confident that they have, at least a good understanding of what they're about to vote on.
In the spirit of Gruenbergian dialogue, I have a Gruenbergian follow-up, which is, I noticed the excise language, independent of the amount of time, brief for 5 minutes, changing that, it toggles from may to shall. And just being a lay reader, not an attorney like my learned colleagues to the right, it seems, just running with the spirit and I think the intent of the amendment, I wonder if it should be may have as opposed to the more imperative shall.
Well, again, in dialogue, I don't know that either is a terrible idea, as long as the person making the motion or making the request for an abstention, you know, has that opportunity, I think that satisfies the spirit of what we're going after.
Representative Ledoux.
If you made it may instead of shall have up to 5 minutes, that would give the speaker, I think, the discretion not to give somebody actually 5 minutes. So the may, and they may make a brief oral statement of the reasons for the request, that leaves it up to the person whether or not they want to make any sort of statement.
Representative Cott.
Mr. Chairman, so I appreciate the maker of the amendments and what they're trying to do here. And looking at this, this may be a rules question. It seems to me like right now there's really no limit on how long you can be. It says a brief oral statement of the reasons for the request, but would this now be inadvertently limiting the speaker to 5 minutes, whereas maybe before there was not any such limit? And it I'm thinking of, you know, you may be explaining exactly what the situation is with a client or an issue, letting the whole body know, whereas maybe now there's not a limit. Maybe we would inadvertently be sticking a limit in there where that really was not our intention. We really do want someone to have the floor and probably would not cut them off if they were explained. So just question for rules, I guess.
So...
Go ahead, Representative Levine.
I actually think whether or not to cut the person off would probably be left to the speaker, perhaps after consulting with rules. Maybe the better part of valor would be if one's really concerned with either the speaker or the rules chair cutting somebody off needlessly based upon his or her understanding of the term brief. Maybe it should simply say may make an oral statement of the obviously it's an oral statement of the reasons for the request. It really doesn't have to have brief in it, in which people could be arguing what's brief. I mean, in some context, brief might be 45 minutes. In another context, it might be 30 seconds.
Representative Fansler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As we're dialoguing, this is probably for my more learned experienced members. Offense meant to Representatives Eastman or Kopp. When these have come up in the past, how long typically have we seen oral statements last? I mean, my envisionment, at least my experience from serving on a municipality council, you know, typically it's, hi, my name's Zach Fanfler, and I have, you know, a conflict of interest because I work for the university. And, you know, and so has there been times where we need to get into it? And then my second part to that is, I wonder perhaps if an open dialogue is allowed at that time, because I would find it very helpful to me if I was going to be making a vote to sometimes ask questions and have follow-up, you know, what do you do for the university? Do you know, like those kinds of things.
Representative.
Go ahead, Representative will do.
Generally, there's the way you've explained it, Representative Fanzer, is pretty correct. Somebody will get up and say they work for the university or work for whoever, and there won't be any discussion whatsoever because virtually between the time that somebody gets up to declare a conflict and towards the end of their sentence, somebody will yell out objection, and the speaker will say, Representative Fanzler, there has been an objection. You are required to vote. I would imagine that if this bill were passed, it would change somewhat. Somebody would actually have to get up there and say what their conflict of interest is, and we'll probably need to enunciate a little bit further than we've come to do it in the past, because it is actually going to have some very real consequences. But when you talk about dialoguing, I mean, you can kind of dialogue in the committee, and questions are permitted on the floor, but I've never seen, you know, just a basic conversation in the House. It's all in the chambers. It's all very formalized.
Representative Eastman.
I was just curious if we could get some more input from the sponsor on this discussion.
That's fine, Representative Glenn. Did you have any thoughts about this? Again, through our understandings, we've actually seen that 5-minute limit put in place in other states. I'd say it's somewhat common. I think the intent through our conversations with other ethics committees, there's a little bit of an anti-filibuster type feeling to it. But also it's an arbitrary number, obviously, but it does give the speaker time to enunciate their conflict and give some explanation. Either way, if they're trying to arise through a conflict and say, I would like to vote or I need to abstain from vote, it gives them a feeling that there's enough time to explain such background.
I would just note, actually this is more a question for Representative Eastman, when I compare Amendment Number 1 to House Concurrent Resolution Number 1, which is the J version, which I think they're all working off. I don't see nodding heads. The amendment is actually not an amendment to Version J, the resolution that's before us. This is actually just an amendment to the existing form of the uniform rule, so that if we adopt Amendment Number 1, not only are we changing existing Rule 34B, but we're pretty much rejecting everything that's changed in Version J, which is the resolution before us, and that's your intent.
It's a replacement, and it basically, in the sense that it's a committee substitute at that point. Like, maybe that's not the proper terminology, but that's the same.
I just wanted to make sure that was your intent, was to replace all the language in that is proposed. All right. Further discussion or dialogue?
Mr. Chair, through the chair for Ryan Johnston, staff representative, Penn. So close to not screwing that up today. To the chair, Representative Vandler, just for clarification for you, that the motion is not debatable, and that's in uniform rules currently and is in this current version as well, just for you to know that. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I don't see Representative O'Dill.
So in this version and the current rules, the motion as to whether or not somebody can abstain is not debatable at all?
To the chair, Representative, that is correct. It is not debatable. The legislator requesting to abstain may stand and make their brief oral statement, and then the motion is taken up with a vote with no debate.
Representative, what is
it? Just to follow up. And that certainly makes a lot of sense in the situation that we've got now. I mean, you might as well not debate something if there's one person who's already made an objection and it needs to be by unanimous consent. I'm just wondering whether in any of the other places where they actually vote on whether or not one it's appropriate to abstain. For example, the municipality of Anchorage. Is there any discussion or debate allowed about that?
Uh,
chair, Representative Ledoux. Yeah, we're looking at the Municipal Officers and Employees, Chapter 29.20 here in the statute. It does not appear... doesn't appear that they allow for debate.
Thank you.
Seeing no other comments, I will make a note that I think that the big question with regard to Amendment Number 1, because there's a lot of questions about whether it shall be may or shall, and whether it will be 5 minutes, which might be painful to some of us taking to speak for 5 minutes, but... the real question is whether we want it by a vote of two-thirds or majority. That's the big question as to the amendment, because I will not be removing my objection, so I will call for the clerk to, for a roll call vote.
Representative Eastman?
Yes.
Representative Reinbold?
Yes.
Representative Cox?
Yes.
Representative Price Thompson?
Nay.
Representative Ledoux?
Nay.
Representative Gansler?
No.
Chair Clayman?
No.
That's 3 yeas, 4 nays.
So that amendment fails.
Well, I guess the question is, are there other amendments at this time? And I know I spoke with Representative Kopp in advance, but go ahead, Representative Kopp.
So, Jenna, thank you for the liberty to go over this conceptually, and I will have this double check it one more time, but I believe this is the... I did speak about this with the bill sponsor, of course, our last chair, and then... again today, but Mr. Chairman, this pertains to version O of the bill, and if we go to page 2 of the bill and look at line 20, this would address the language where it says, unless required by the uniform rules, a legislator may not vote on a question before a committee of the legislature, and it would change it to where it would just say, a legislator shall request to be excused from voting on a question before a house of the legislature if the legislator or a member of the legislator's immediate family has a financial interest in the business. So, Mr. Chairman, what it does is I think it gets at the heart of the matter of we want the full disclosure on the floor, the whole body can hear it, and then, call for the vote and it would take out the seeming unnecessary obstacle of one person not being allowed to vote because they may believe that they have a conflict, which on the floor they would declare and still have an option of voting depending on how the whole vote of the body goes. But in a committee, that one vote being denied could have a much greater impact. And... in the House, we have more members of each committee. In the Senate, they only have 5, and towards the end of session, it can be tough to make a quorum. The other may have 3. And so my argument for this would be, I think we're within the spirit of what we're trying to do here in the bill and not take away the committee work. I would hope that a member who felt they were conflicted would say so even in committee, but right now it says that it may not vote. And that may be something that just goes beyond what we really need to when we have the House floor issue covered, when the whole body can hear the objection and decide at that time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just for the committee's purpose, because we have a policy that we're asking for amendments by 5 o'clock in the day before, and we only got that today. We're not going to vote on this amendment, but turning it a conceptual amendment so that we can hear the perspective, and I would expect the next time you hear this bill, we will take this amendment up, or to the extent... it's a conceptual amendment, so... Okay. I'll object for purposes of discussion. Thank you, Madam Clerk. Anyway, so I would expect that we'll take this up at the next time we hear this bill, but we can certainly discuss it now.
if there are questions. Representative Christ Tompkins.
It makes sense to me.
Representative Grant, you look like you've got a thought on this. I'll go ahead.
Mr. Chair, thank you. To Representative Kopp, yes, I think we agree with the statement that this really helps get to the heart of what the intent of the bill is allowing for a vote to take place on the floor and not to feel like we're automatically eliminating someone's representation of their district by a vote in a small place like a committee. So we would be friendly to the sort of amendment.
Representative Kansler? I wasn't sure if that was a gesture to get defensive.
That was. this is a directive to the chair to either Representative Grant or Representative Kopp. My understanding of the bill, one of the key reasons that it's being brought before us is to make sure that we get these things on the record. And I would wonder if Representative Kopp would be okay with maybe having language such as that where you recognize that you have a possible conflict of interest on the committee record and then you're still allowed to vote, so you would, you know, it would get it out there and you would be able to say, you know, I have this conflict of interest, but the rule being, since it's a committee, you're allowed to participate in discussion and amendments and things like that. And both of your
like Representative Kopp is ready first, so we'll hear from Representative.
I mean, that through the chair, Representative Sandler, that absolutely is consistent with my position. Like I said, I would hope they would disclose, but that the legislation wouldn't stop them from voting at that point. And the point being, Cindy would be on the floor. But thank you.
Representative Graham, do you have thoughts as well?
Through the chair, Representative Vansler, currently in uniform rules now, there's nothing to say that you need to declare a conflict in committee. We can do it in a good gesture now, but there's nothing in uniform rules that that says you need to currently.
Well, it presents an interesting question. I was speaking with Representative Kopp about this before we convened, and it presents an interesting question. For example, on this committee, if a bill was in front of us and I owned stock in some company that would create a basis for me to claim a conflict, that conflict would not, I would still count for purposes of reaching the quorum for the committee to meet. But then let's say this is a bill that I've announced this conflict that I'll be raising when we get in front of the House floor, and then the public is very concerned about people with this interest voting on legislation, and so then the bill passes out of committee by a 4-3 vote with Klayman having disclosed this conflict, and Klayman's the fourth vote that gets it through the committee, and so those in the public that would object to our voting on bills in which we have an interest and say, look, it even made it on a committee because Klayman had this conflict. And so I raised kind of that question, because if the intent of the bill is to make it so that the public has assurances that people with a conflict aren't taking actions inconsistent with that, does this make the public any happier if, having reached the quorum, then the person with the conflict, in this example of me, is nevertheless allowed to vote on whether the bill goes on a committee rather than abstaining in committee and leave it to the remainder of the committee to gather their votes to move it forward? I don't. And in the Senate, that might be, rather than a 7-member committee with 4 people needing to pass it, in the Senate, that might be a 5-person committee with 3 votes needed to pass something. I raise that for purposes of discussion. It reflects a certain concern with the public perception. And that raises the doubt. We've got some hands coming up, and our representative will do.
You know, you're right that there's nothing about this in the uniform rules. But I think, if my memory serves me correctly, that there are some opinions from legislative legal floating out there as to whether or not you're required to mention a conflict in the committee process. And while I can't put my finger on it right now, I think that there is something in Mason's, which we look to when the uniform rules doesn't specifically cover things. So I'm almost positive there's a legal opinion out there as to what you're supposed to do when it comes to a committee conflict, as far as identifying that you've got a conflict.
Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, like you mentioned, in the other body, if you have three people at a hearing, one has a conflict. If the other two are divided, one that, you know, the bill fails, doesn't get out of committee. So the problem with full public transparency is it never really gets to the floor where all the members get to hear the conflict and get to hear a much larger, all the people out in media land would hear much more effectively what the conflict is. And because we are now voting, the speaker would definitely be laying it all out there. And I just think, you're right, there's more members on this side, but I think where this will be more of a problem is in the other body because of the small size of the committee.
Representative Fred Tompkins?
I was going to ask if Doug Gardner is online and maybe you could add insight to Representative Ledoux's question or recollection.
Mr. Gardner, you were online today?
Nope. I see the head shaking in the back.
Sure. Jerry Anderson is on the line from Ledge Ethics if you'd like to ask his opinion on the committee situation or if any of the members of the committee would like.
Representative Christ Tompkins, would you like Mr. Anderson to answer the question to the extent he has information to provide?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I think it'd be better than nothing.
Mr. Anderson, can you hear us?
Yes.
Did you hear the question from Representative Grimm?
I did.
If you could go ahead and answer that question.
Mr. Chair, this was a question from Representative Christ Tompkins, I believe. And concerning that and concerning Representative Ledoux's recollection, she is correct on that, that the advisory opinions issued by the committee all the way back to 2004, specifically advisory opinion 2004-02, have that specific provision in it where it does not apply to voting in a committee, and very explicit about that. Subsequent opinions have also stated that same fact.
Representative Chris Tompkins, any follow-up?
No.
Representative Ledoux. Mr. Anderson, could you identify yourself for the record? I thought we had, but didn't do it effectively.
I'm very sorry about that. My name is Jerry Anderson. I'm the administrator for the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics.
Representative Ledoux.
So, Mr. Anderson, do any of the advisory opinions say whether or not you're supposed to identify that you have a conflict and then vote anyway?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I believe that you're talking about action in the committee. And
in the committee.
They specifically state that you are not required under the current rules and statute to extend that to the committee. And that would include chairing a committee, debating in a committee, or voting in a committee.
So, just a comment.
Go ahead, Representative Levine.
So, do the ethics rules both parallel criminal, state criminal law and federal law? Because I seem to recall some sort of law cases in federal court dealing with honest services, and I thought people got in trouble in maybe our state, maybe other states, for not identifying a conflict or a potential conflict all the way through the process. And does anybody know what I'm looking at, Representative Klayman, because I think I'm trying to state the name of that statute.
I don't.
It has something to do with honest services.
And Representative LeDoux, I have a similar memory when you brought out about either a statute or a common law doctrine regarding honest services, something or another. But I can't get more detail than that.
Chairman,
Representative Cox.
Yes,
we're going to dialogue.
Yes, commission.
Yes, commission to dialogue. Proceed.
Representative LeDoux has a good memory. So, yes, in Alaska statutes, there is three statutes that talk about misuse of public office or abuse of public office, and they talk about taking or failing to take an action that you should have or should not have done, and I think conflicts are addressed in that. I'm positive they are. And that's actually in the little criminal law book that APOA puts out, Representative LeDoux. And so that's a good memory. I do know it's addressed several places in our statutes. It would probably have to be fairly egregious to be applied against a legislator, but it is addressed in the law.
You never know. And I think there is a federal doctrine there, too, that it talks in terms of honest services.
I got a note that the legislative legal is having Dan Lane, who was the legal member in legislative legal that worked on the bill, call in. Mr. Lane, are you on the phone yet? Not yet. Okay. Any further comments? Do we want to wait a couple minutes to see if Mr. Wayne comes on before we proceed, or this is admittedly a conceptual amendment, so we will have further opportunity in the future to take it up. Anybody want to wait for Mr. Wayne, or are we okay to proceed?
Are we, when you say proceed, are we going to discuss the bill anymore today?
This amendment isn't before us because it's a conceptual amendment. We'll take it up at our next meeting. But if you have thoughts on this, you're certainly welcome to share them. We can talk about them now.
On the bill.
We're right now talking about the conceptual amendment.
That's
why we're doing. Right. Okay. So nothing more as to this conceptual amendment. We will, I think, then our next stop, we're not going to take up this amendment now. You don't need anything useful from you on the record for that?
No, I put it in here, but if Representative Cox is accepting Representative Jansberg's suggestion, I mean, is it going to be an amendment to Amendment 1 to Conceptual Amendment 2?
Well, since the amendment isn't before us, it's only formally a conceptual amendment. They can work that out between now and our next meeting on this bill, and when we actually hear the amendment, we'll see what it looks like.
But, Mr. Chairman, just for timing, where would that be?
We're going to go on Wednesday. I think we're going to try to take this up again on Friday.
Right.
Okay, so we try to get something to us by 5 o'clock on Thursday. And I think the only other thing we can, as Representative Reingold would like to make some comments on the bill, if you'd like, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Klayman. So basically, I'm trying to understand, you know, the intent of the legislation. So basically, right now, we all obviously have the opportunity to declare, you know, a conflict, and we have it on financial records, our community vets us, et cetera. So historically, we've allowed all members to vote to make sure that 18,000 members that we represent are not disenfranchised. That's typically because we're citizens' legislature. So I'm trying to understand the sponsor's motivation behind the bill. So any member of the legislature that makes greater than $10,000, let's say from a client that you represent, or if your spouse or you work for the UAA, or anybody works for public schools, any state employees, anybody who has any interest in IBEW or anything like that, anybody who owns any stocks and may, they're lucky, I guess, get more than $10,000, retirement benefits, I'm not sure if that, you know, if that's encompassed in this, if they get more than $10,000 of benefits from, let's say, the state pervertors, they need to recuse themselves from a committee vote or a vote on the House floor. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, I don't believe that to be correct.
How is it incorrect?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, in each of these situations...
What's your name?
Ryan Johnson, staff representative, Grant, I apologize. In each of these situations, you would need to have a fact-based inquiry, so we would need more details on each situation to determine whether or not, in the current bill, that you fell underneath the substantial benefit or interest from said situation. So, to make a blanket statement would be... hard to do, and we would need more details on each situation to determine whether or not there is a substantial conflict of interest.
And through the chair, it's very clear. If you got $10,000 from UAA, from public school, from a state employee, from union, stock, private, you know, anybody, private sector, retirement benefits, it's very, very clear. Is $10,000, or are you targeting individuals, maybe members who are work in the private sector? So we're trying to, does this include all public sector employees and benefits, et cetera, as well, or is it alienated to a smaller group?
Ryan Johnson, staff representative, Grand, through the chair, Representative Reinbold, it dictates that if you have an income of $10,000, it could be public, it could be private, you could run your own business if you made that $10,000, and in said situation, your business made a substantial benefit from the passage of a certain legislation, more so than the rest of that class, business or industry, you could determine whether you not have a conflict of interest.
Follow-up, Representative Randall?
Well, I'm just trying to see, it sounds like this is kind of subjective as we talk in the office. This is very subjective, and it's a concern. Because how are we supposed to know on everybody's, we don't get to see everybody's income tax and find out, you know, if they make more than $10,000 from stocks or from UAA or public schools or anything, even retirement benefits. It's hard for us to be able to see all that information before every single committee vote and before, and things can change. I mean, incomes can change. So it's to me, very challenging. We're going to have to spend a lot of time trying to figure out and studying people's financial records before we go to a vote before the committee or before the House floor vote.
Any follow-up response? Not necessarily required, but it's more important. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Randall, it is subjective. We honor each one of us to have the integrity and the wherewithal to know when we need to rise to a conflict of interest to ourselves. And this doesn't change that. This does put it the measure to stand on the legislator themselves to recognize when they have a conflict based on what we're proposing.
Thank you, Representative. Any further follow-up? I did. Representative Eastman.
Yes, and not to retread over too much ground from before, but just a clarifying question to the sponsor. Under the current situation, you know, we do have an ethics committee and they do deal with things like conflicts. So how would these types of situations be handled if your bill had never been proposed? I understand what is going to take place if it passes. What do we revert to if it does not pass?
One of you want to take that?
Ryan Johnson, staff representative, Grimm, through the chair, Representative Ethan. So currently, there's the unanimous abstention you can ask to abstain. But if a legislator feels that another legislator did not declare a conflict of interest, there is the Ledge Ethics. You can make an anonymous complaint, and then Ledge Ethics takes over and investigates that allegation. And so, that's the current process now.
A follow-up?
Sure. I have Representative Eastman.
Thank you. So currently you would pursue a complaint through Ledge Ethics, and by putting this into statute now, you're effectively taking it out of the realm of wedge ethics and making it a state law, so someone will be prosecuted by a district attorney and that side of the process. Am I understanding that correctly?
Ryan Johnson, staff to Representative Grant, through the chair, Representative Eaton. Actually, it just provides a better standard for ledge ethics to actually be able to refer back to AS 2460-030 and look back and say, oh, this is another standard we could use. Because AS 2460-030 does deal with ledge ethics, so it falls under the purview of legislative ethics, the committee to deal with that complaint.
And Representative Christ Tompkins and the rest of the committee, I got a note that Dan Wayne from Legislative Legal is on the line to the extent that there were questions anyone wanted to ask him. I see many head nodding, Mr. Wayne, but no questions coming forward. All right. I don't see anyone else that wants to add comments or ask questions, so what we will do at this point, we will hold House Bill 44 and House Concurrent Resolution 1 at this time for further review, and we'll consider other proposed amendments. As I explained, I expect we'll hear this bill again on Friday, subject to getting notice that maybe we're not quite ready to hear it on Friday, but that's the current plan. And with that, we will stand adjourned. The time is now 3:32 p.m.